As our first year of All in Bitcoin comes to a close, we want to say a huge thank you to our audience and every incredible guest who joined us on this journey. Adam Back, Peter Todd, John Carballo, Jamison Love, Rockstar, Martin Malmy, Trace Mayer, Alex B, Pierre Rochard, Jimmy Son, Jack Cruz, Mike Peterson, Nicola Borte, Willy Wu, Ben Perrin, Abubakar Nerkalil, Jeff Booth, Derek Ross, and Max K. And a special thank you to Bitbox, our very first sponsor, joining us right at the end of this year. Up until now, we funded every single episode entirely ourselves. Your support, whether it's a donation, a comment, or subscribing and hitting the bell, really helps these conversations reach further. And it gives us the push to keep going, to keep traveling, keep preparing, and keep bringing you in-person conversations like this. Thank you for being part of our journey. Here is to many more episodes together. CK and the All in Bitcoin team. All music is composed by Jeroen Huyus. You'll find a link in the show notes.
All views expressed by the host or guests are solely their own opinions. Nothing stated in this podcast should be considered a specific endorsement to make any particular investment or follow any specific strategy.
Everything started when Satoshi Nakamoto released his white paper in January 3rd, 2009.
That's actually not true.
No.
So okay. The white paper was actually released earlier.
Okay.
Also, January 3rd, 2009 mm-hmm. is the date in the Genesis block.
Yeah.
But that's not when Bitcoin really launched. Well, when it really launched was a couple days later when the code was released. And I think, off the top of my head, I think that was like January 9th, 2009.
January 9th.
Yeah. Because the thing is, what made Bitcoin Bitcoin was not that it had a Genesis block. It's that people had access to the code and could run it. Similarly, launching like the white paper didn't do anything. It's just a piece of paper. You know, it's just like a description of the system. It's not the system itself. What made Bitcoin Bitcoin was launching the code and making it available to the general public. Notably, you know, the very first block mined after the Genesis block, like the first block to actually be mined, was probably not mined by Satoshi. It was probably mined by just some random dude who downloaded the code. Now, we don't happen to know who that random dude is because they've never piped up, but very likely it was some random guy who just downloaded it, tried it for a bit, mined a block, and then deleted it.
Can you explain in simple terms Bitcoin mining?
So... The idea is, I guess, a bit like a lottery. By doing mining, your miner is do a calculation, which it can't predict the outcome. And the outcome, it's a big number. So if you look at it, it will have a certain number of zeros at the beginning, and it's unpredictable. So your miner is just going to keep trying numbers until it finds a number with a lot of zeros, and then it will send that to a mining pool and to the network. And the network has a minimum that it will accept. And if you get enough zeros, you can take the next block, which will give you the financial reward. Effectively, it's a sort of race between all of the miners to see who can find enough zeros on this calculation. And so it's a little bit like throwing coins and seeing if you have a head or a tail. If you count the tail as a zero, you need, you know, a lot of the coins to land with a tail. It's extremely unlikely per try to have the right number of tails, but there are a lot of mining machines and they're guessing a lot of times per second. So the total hash rate is, you know, up in the 500 exahash. So a terahash is a trillion. So this is 5 million trillion tries per second, which is a lot, right? So it's an unimaginably large number. And so even though the chances of, you know, doing it once and having a fantastical number of zeros, probabilistically, they're trying so often that the chances of somebody finding a block in 10 minutes is 50-50. So that's what it's doing. But it's really a game of chance. So that's why the block interval can sometimes be 1 minute, sometimes 20 minutes, but centered on the 10-minute target.
When I share quotes that align with libertarian principles, people tend to agree because they just make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about these principles by exploring some thought-provoking quotes.
All right.
Here is the first quote. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, by Thomas Jefferson. Do you hold these truths to be self-evident?
I think all people are created equal in the sense that we should not be aggressed upon, like we should be allowed to do what we want if we're not hurting others. Though I think a lot of people misunderstand what equality means. You know, equality of opportunity, equality of outcome, you know, these things are not guaranteed rights, especially when you're talking about rights. And why a lot of people disagree with libertarianism is because libertarianism is mostly about negative rights, which means that you have the right not to have bad things, you know, forced upon you. On the other hand, a lot of people who are more statists, and when they talk about rights, they will often talk about what you would call positive rights, which would mean things like, you know, you should have the right to get paid some minimum amount, or you should have the right to receive, you know, some sort of subsidy or help for things. In order to provide those positive rights, you have to aggress upon someone else's negative rights. Like you have to take from someone else, often without their consent. So it's not, I think it's not really possible to have a world or a system that offers people positive rights without harming some people's negative rights.
I was going to ask you how far you think you are from your vision.
Maybe 60% done with the first version. We announced a project called PubKey. PubKey is an overarching name for an ecosystem of software and protocols and apps that we've created. So that consists of PubKey Core and PubKey App so far, and a bunch of other tools. PubKey Core is sort of this system for using keys. Like as you use a Bitcoin key, a different type of keys that work very similarly, you use these keys in a way that your key is like a domain name. So instead of having to buy a domain name from some authority, some provider, and then be subject to possible censorship from them, you actually could take your key and you can turn it into a domain name or an identity, and you could have multiple of them if you really wanted. So you take this key and you sign a DNS record and you put it in what's called a DHT network. A DHT network is the same network that BitTorrent uses, except we don't use it for that necessarily. We use the structure of the network and how it manages this hash table. So when people want to look up where your website is or your profile or how to pay you, whatever it may be that you want to control through your key, they just go to that network and they ask the network, and it's the most decentralized network on the internet, millions of nodes. So it's extremely censorship resistant. And now we use this to point to what we call home servers. You get to have the advantages of a server, but none of the disadvantages if that server goes away or kicks you off. If that server censors you in some way, you go and get your key from cold storage, you choose a different provider or you self-host, you update your record in the DHT, and you point to that new place. And this way you don't lose any of the integrity of your data or any of your followers or any of your context. Nostr comes to mind quickly for Bitcoiners more than most other industries interested in tech like this. There are actually things like Nostr that are much bigger than Nostr, that have many more users than Nostr.
Let's move to another passion of yours, which is Nostr.
Let's go.
What is Nostr in simple terms?
So Nostr is really a simple protocol that enables exchange of this, like notes and other stuff transmitted on relays, which is really what Nostr acronym stands for. It's a really simple protocol where I, as individual, I create these JSON files, sign them cryptographically, and send them to relays where they're available for anyone to download. And the first big application of Nostr is social media, like recreating. But I really see, as more people create identities, those private public key pairs, and start creating JSON files, and more use cases will arise. Private messengers, they're going to use Nostr as a protocol to exchange nodes between people. It's really a great protocol. And then you can go Google Noster GitHub. You'll get to Fia Jeff's manifesto on what Noster is. Use that as an intro.
Do you have a metaphor for explaining Noster?
Yeah, I don't have a metaphor. That's interesting. No. Now, maybe I should develop one. Maybe we can develop it together.
Maybe, but it's not that easy to explain.
Yeah, the way that it works is if I took this piece of paper and I wrote something on it, like it's blank, and then I signed it. Yes. And I took that note and put it in some kind of storage that's available for anyone to come and pick up the note. It's digital, so that person taking the note, they're not taking the note, it's staying on the relay. But they verify the signature and then they know it's a message from me. So that's what really Noster is for non-technical people.
Can you talk about the problem with private chats in Noster DMs and the solution you came up with?
Oh yeah, so Noster is censorship resistance technology. Privacy was not the design goal with Noster, and direct messages were like quickly glued on solution. So on Noster currently, direct message content is encrypted, but the sender and recipient and timestamp are visible. So you can check out someone's chat history and you can see every message they sent and when they sent and whom, but you just don't see the content. So I have recently done an improvement on this. I want to do like signal style double ratchet algorithm. So you would use session keys that are only on your device and you periodically rotate, create a new key. So that provides so-called forward and backward secrecy. So even if your main Noster private key is compromised, your past and future chats will be safe. And also the metadata will be hidden. I have actually already done the first part of the double ratchet. I just need the second part, which provides even more reassurance if you use disappearing messages or if you delete your chat history, then it's gone for good with the second ratchet added. It's still working on it.
Bitcoin is about shifting from trusting to verifying. What was the biggest shift for you in this process?
Yeah, I think that there's just the idea that you can have this distributed consensus and that you can run your own full node and have your own rules that you're using to validate whether you received Bitcoins or not. Like that whole process, like, I mean, that's a big shift. You used to log into a website or you log into your online banking or, I mean, that's just the way all those things were done. But now it's like, man, we actually like got these Bitcoins showing up on the full node and like really understanding and grasping like what we're doing, kind of writing about the gold. You know, one of the issues is like, you know, do the central banks actually have the physical gold they say they have? And in order to verify, you have to melt down the gold bar and recast it. And that costs, you know, a lot of money. And if you go outside of that chain of custody, that LBMA chain of custody, the LBMA bar loses 5 to 7% of its value. And yet for a couple Satoshis, we're able to melt down Bitcoin UTXOs and recast them and effectively assay that with 100% guarantee by running our full node. So like not only are we able to protect those UTXOs much more cost efficiently than we do with gold, but we're also able to verify the quantity and the quality of them. And so that was a big shift in my own mind because, I mean, that's the new innovation that Bitcoin's really brought to the world, right? Is like being able to do that in such a cheap, cost-efficient way. And then capital, of course, is now honing in on that and being like, oh, that's great. And we have a high stock-to-flow ratio. It's now the cheapest, most efficient way to kind of store capital into the future because of that.
Let's talk about ARK Labs.
ARK is a scaling proposal. Some people call it a layer two. I think it's a bit of a semantics conversation. So the way I like to look at it is sort of a multi-party contract on Bitcoin. You have two-party contracts on Bitcoin. Those are lightning channels, for example. Mm-hmm. Two people interacting together, opening channels, and obviously through lightning, those channels can be connected to the wider network. A multi-party contract, it really is, you could say maybe like a multi-sig almost. If you have a multi-sig that involves different signers, and those are really like on-chain contracts, right? But the idea with Arc is to get a group of people together, basically team them up with a server that acts as another party in that contract. And through the interaction with this server, the people that are involved in Arc service or with the Arc server are able to batch off-chain transactions into a single on-chain transaction. It's this idea of like a shared UTXO. And why shared UTXOs are important is realistically, Lightning alone is not sufficient to scale the adoption of Bitcoin to the entire world. But this arrangement of shared UTXO is sort of coordinated with this entity, which is the Arc server, who posts regularly, periodically, a transaction on-chain. And within that on-chain transaction is confined a bunch of different individuals that have their own shares, and they can exchange their shares between each other. So it becomes kind of like really this off-chain construct that is kind of like UTXO native. So it's the same model of transactions that Bitcoin uses. It uses the same Bitcoin script primitives that Bitcoin use, but really allows you to amortize the cost of almost a limitless amount of Bitcoin operations into a much smaller on-chain footprint. Arc is super interesting ways to scale Bitcoin script, which is like scale all of those cool things that you can do on chain, but that are too expensive. You just do them off chain and then you kind of like batch the outcome. So like almost like the settlement in single shared UTXOs.
What drives you totally insane?
Right now, it's really around environmentalism. So I think that the environmentalist movement has been hijacked by the carbon cult that wants to use carbon emissions and global warming as a way of controlling the global economy, and that's their priority, rather than having a priority of let's improve the environment and let's clean it up. Because I think that there's lots of forms of pollution that are far easier to address than carbon emissions. So, for example, seed oils in our food are pollution, right? You've got people who are feeding their children engine oil, and the people are getting sick from all of this. You've got an obesity epidemic. It's having just tremendous, devastating costs on society today. And then they're obsessed with carbon emissions in 2050. You've got microplastics. So just tiny pieces of plastic in the food supply that we're all eating. We're eating microplastics. Terrible form of pollution. Not a priority. No, the priority is making sure that you don't use electricity because of the indirect carbon emissions. So that I think, is what drives me crazy. I think that because the way that we address all the forms of real pollution is through technological progress, through increased energy use, and plenty of countries, whether it's France or the United States, struggle with the problem of litter, right? Trash out in the streets. And what we need are robots that automatically go around and pick up the trash, right? And that takes up technology and that takes up lots of electricity, but it's good for the environment. And so the modern environmentalist movement is actually a form of pagan worship where they worship the sun. So they like solar. They worship Gaia, Mother Nature. They want degrowth and they hate humans, right? They see humans as a form of cancer on Earth and that they want to see the population decrease. And so I think that they're just kind of a lunatic religion that's not grounded in enlightenment values of human dignity and reason.
Well said.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Bitbox, the Bitcoin hardware wallet that guards your sovereignty. The Bitcoin-only Bitbox 02 Nova is Swiss-built, intuitive, fully open source, comes with a micro SD card, and is protected by a secure element. So keep your Bitcoin on your Bitbox, offline and safe where it belongs. Go to bitbox.swiss and use code ALLINBITCOIN for 5% off or check the show notes. Does government intervention ever truly solve the problem it seeks to address?
No, it doesn't. Because, this is kind of obvious when you look at a place like San Francisco or I guess California more broadly. They spend an insane amount of money on homelessness. right? And they have been for many years. But why isn't homelessness getting eliminated, right? The city of San Francisco spends like $1 billion a year on homelessness. Like over the past 15 years, it's actually gotten worse. So what's going on? Well, it turns out that when they're spending $1 billion, they assign it to some, you know, government agency, right? Or NGO or whatever. And for those people, their priority is not eliminating homelessness, even though that's in their charter or whatever. They want to keep their jobs. If they eliminated homelessness, they would be out of a job. So it's in their interest to continue it and make it actually kind of worse so they get a bigger budget and then they get paid more. So this happens all over the economy where you don't have competition, right? Because if you had competition, like, you know, somebody makes burritos here and somebody makes burritos here and the ones over there kind of stink, then, you know, the one that does better wins. If you don't have competition and you're just sort of pouring money into a black hole, the problem only gets worse. And this is true of almost everything. And it's kind of counterintuitive because the normal voter is like, okay, well, we want to improve education, so we should give more money to the Department of Education. And then they give more money to the Department of Education. What happens? It gets worse, right? Like, and they ask for even more money. And, and you know, there are all these like U.S. school districts where they spend more money per pupil, like in a lot of these inner cities than like the suburbs, and they do like worse and worse and worse. Why? Because there's nobody motivated to go and actually fix this stuff. There's no competition. It's just pouring money down a black hole. So yeah, like money doesn't solve this thing. And we pretend that it does, but absent competition, absent market forces, it doesn't do anything. It actually makes the problem much worse.
You are frustrated about El Salvador?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Bukele gave the people of El Salvador the greatest gift that a politician could ever give. Why? Politicians never give people power and control. Bukele did that. He did that before he put in the exception regime to go after MS-13. So what does that tell you? His priorities were right. Fix the money and then fix everything else. The country's completely changed in 5 years. But what's the frustration? Bukele has to build the middle class out here in El Salvador. That's the single most important thing. But Salvadorians need to take their head out of their ass and buy a little bit of Bitcoin. Because the whole country changes if they understand this very simple idea. This is, you don't even have to think six steps ahead, just one step ahead. And Bukele, the reason I respect him, in my opinion, the greatest president of any country of all time. I used to put him behind George Washington. Now I think he's exceeded it. He is still buying Bitcoin now when he makes the deal with the IMF. He's telling the IMF, I'm going to do what's right for my people. But the people of El Salvador need to realize they all need to have Strike wallets. They all need to have Moon wallets. They need to start saving some of their money, even if it's 5 or 10% in Bitcoin and not in American dollars. If they do that, El Salvador could have a bigger ascent than the United States did from 1850 to probably 1945.
What's something you have changed your mind about since starting Bitcoin Beach?
Man, you got some hard questions. I think one thing I've changed my mind about is that there's like a right and wrong way to do things. I've seen that really there's lots of different ways to go about having an impact. And so I think that's what's so great about the way Bitcoin is designed. It's decentralized. And so you don't have this top down, like there's one specific way to best have an impact. And so we're seeing now there's all these other, you know, communities springing up, like you see Berlin, and now in Punta Mongo, there's La Paria. You see that there's not like a necessarily right and wrong way. And yeah, I like seeing it done by different people in different ways rather than it being like this top down, where I would have thought before, like, okay, we need to have this formula and, you know, we teach everybody how to do it. And the way it's happened has been more organic of people take bits and learnings of what we've done. They use the white paper, but then they make changes that work better in their community. And then a lot of times they'll feedback to us like, hey, we're doing this and it's really working. And then we can integrate that in our project.
What's the most unexpected lesson you've learned?
Probably that building in the Bitcoin world is the most challenging industry to work on.
Why is that?
Fighting the odds for everything. Like on one hand, you're building technology for sovereign individual, but those people are low time preference. So typically they might not want to spend money on, you know, goods and services. So you have a lot of pressure from government. Funding in this ecosystem is much scarcer than in other industry. If you compare crypto versus Bitcoin, there is like 100 times more funding in the crypto space. And maybe the Bitcoin for corporation like is changing a little bit that, but that still doesn't mean there is a lot of money for people building tools in the Bitcoin ecosystem. So building as an entrepreneur in the Bitcoin space is very challenging. And when I started 6 years ago, I would not have guessed that it would be as challenging.
So do you trust stable coins not to be frozen or confiscated in a major financial or government crisis?
You know, I wouldn't put in my bank cash any significant amount because of that bail-in threshold. In terms of Tether or Circle,
yeah,
or, you know, there's what changes every day, but I think it's around 170 billion US dollars in that pool of capital. Is the US government coming in to freeze that? They might take the money out of your bank account, but to take $170 billion from Tether or mm-hmm. Circle, who's going to buy their T-bills if they do that, right? The US government requires buyers of their debt. And the fastest growing buyer of debt is Tether right now. In fact, if Bitcoin price goes over the next 10 years to $1 million, the T-bill buying, the short-dated T-bill buying is more than enough to replace China, who have stopped buying the T-bills. So the US government debt is reliant on stable coins growing. So I don't think they're going to freeze that because that's kind of committing suicide on their debt. They could do it, but that would be an absolute crisis, like absolute crisis, a fall of a nation state. That could happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, that, like, if that happens, it's the nation state's going down.
Yeah.
That could happen.
So you've done a lot of explaining. What's the one thing you wish someone had explained to you?
I wish that I would have had, and not pertaining to Bitcoin specifically, but I wish I would have had any sort of financial education growing up. I had nothing. Like you get out of school, they don't teach you a damn thing. And so I entered adulthood with no ability to save. Every dollar I earned, I spent. Not only understanding of just personal finances or the financial system itself, but just habits as well. And so if somebody had taught me how to properly, you know, spend less than you earn and manage personal finances, that would have been a huge help, because even early on in Bitcoin, it helped me. Bitcoin itself taught me that through pain.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, Bitcoin was the first time that I ever learned to save whatsoever, because there was an incentive to do so. But I also didn't stem the bad habits yet. And so doing things like, oh, I'm going to pay off a credit card with Bitcoin, but I hadn't addressed the underlying issue, which was I racked up my credit card because I was spending more than I earned. And so I some of the most regretful moments were, oh, I'll pay off that credit card with Bitcoin. The Bitcoin would be worth so much more now. And on top of that, the credit card just got racked up again. And so I had to learn like, oh, Bitcoin isn't fixing my problem. I need to fix me and then I'll be able to thrive with Bitcoin.
This resonates with so many people.
Yes.
What's your biggest fear for Bitcoin Core over the next 5 years?
Like I said, though, we have a walled garden. I think it's, again, it's very, very easy. And we've seen in other ecosystems and open source where it starts off with good intentions around hygiene when it comes to how you talk to people or what is a productive conversation, what is spamming, ironically. And I think it's very, very easy for developers that are highly involved or even maintainers to start to be a little bit unnecessarily antagonistic to people that maybe aren't constructively criticizing them and marking that as spam or locking conversations and things around that. I think it's going to be one of the bigger challenges for us, even more so than like funding developers to put in code changes. I think we have to be really, really careful about that human element around creating a division between the people that use the code versus those that build it.
As a non-technical person, I think you need to leave the technical stuff to the technical people. But I also think that the technical people should be able to explain what they are doing in words that we get.
100%. I like that you brought that up because it's often overlooked. Like what I would say to the non-technical crowd is the moment it becomes obvious that a person is unable to communicate in layman's terms what they're trying to do, then there likely is either one of two things. One, maybe they don't understand what the hell they're talking about. Or two, they're trying to hide something. So typically you're able to call out BS when it comes to highly technical folks. It's very easy for a technical person to hide into all the technical jargon and make you feel like, oh, you know, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But a lot of that is kind of diversion tactics on the side of developers. And I see on the other side too, like, again, to answer your question directly, I think the best language when it comes to how to interact between the devs and the non-devs is the language of empathy. Like at the end of the day, like for technical folks, they have to remember that the folks you're talking to in terms of the non-technical are not as directly involved with the code base. So there's so much that they're definitely unaware of, not because they're ignorant or they're not intelligent, but because they're not aware. Like you're working on code and they're not. And I think on the non-technical side as well, I think really it's around trying to be as straightforward in terms of the communication and kind of the points you're trying to make. Don't beat around the bush with trying to beat them down to make yourself feel like you're on the same level. Like regardless, we're all on the same level. Like the whole division around, oh, I'm a dev and you're not a dev and there's like hierarchy doesn't make any sense. And that's like the worst case scenario for Bitcoin land if we start to think from that perspective.
What are the consequences? The
consequences are an instability in a system that must forever grow more debt. Or face complete and utter collapse completely. And so because we won't let this system face complete and utter collapse, we will always vote for more debt. So it isn't the government, it's us.
How do you see the end of this?
So these reset happen through war.
And how
they happen is you have to convince the people in your country that there's an enemy within the country. And you divide your nation. And then once you've divided it and take more control and more power from them, and it's building more and more instability because it's unbroken money, it's stealing from them to take more control, you have to create a bigger enemy. You have to create a bigger problem that you have to solve. Whether that problem is COVID, whether that problem is Russia, whether that problem is you have to create China, you have to create a bigger enemy for the same people to then trust you to be able to save them. You have to kill millions of people all over the world. And then the winner of that war, which there's really no winners of that war, go and reset all the institutions and start again. And the same thing happens again.
Just an anecdote. We launched at the end of January. And by March, our account on X was suspended.
So you know.
You feel helpless and nauseous because there it goes, all the content you created, and you don't know why. Then I think when it happens to you, then is when you get it.
Yeah.
And you get like, on Nostra, I cannot have this problem.
Absolutely. It can't happen. And if it would happen, let's say if whatever Nostra app, we keep talking about Domus. Domus probably won't do this. But for example, if Domus decided, I don't like you and I'm going to ban you, that sucks. But okay, I'll take my profile, my NSEC, I'll pop it into another app, to Primal, for example, and I'll sign in and there you go. All my stuff is with me. And then if Primal says, hey, I don't like you, I'm going to ban you, that sucks. Okay, I'll take my key and I'll pop it into Iris. There's dozens of other apps. And even if all of the apps for some reason ban you, you can run your own app on your own home computer that's installed and running on your home computer or home server. You can run your own. Like if Twitter bans me, I can't run my own Twitter off of my home computer or home server. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm banned. Where Nostra, you have that opportunity. It's really hard. Like you can't ban somebody. You could play a game of whack-a-mole and relays could ban you and clients can ban you, but you can jump around and port your whole entire social graph and all your content. You own it, so you can take it with you. You can't really effectively ban somebody.
Is there a wishing box for 2027 Honey Badger?
Since it's 10 years anniversary, I definitely want to have a good roster of speakers. Mm-hmm. Definitely, I want to have all the OGs coming in, like again, our trio, bright trio, you know, Peter, Todd, Giacomo, and Adam, because I think they need to be there. And as far as I understand, they will be there. As of speakers, I would definitely love to have Andres back.
Imagine.
He was one of the reasons why Honey Badger actually started and actually, you know, kickstarted the Honey Badger. So I would love to have him back to give a speech or whatever, share opinion, because he's like super important for our conference. I'm trying to get Paolo to the conference. He never been there, so hopefully he will join us in 2027. And I really enjoyed Jack Dorsey when he was in Riga. You know, mm-hmm. It was a good talk, and would love to have him back. I mean, there's a lot of like good speakers. It hasn't to be necessary person with huge amount of followers. It's just there are like speakers who are like not even on Twitter, but I always enjoy when they come to our conference and they always deliver high quality opinion. We don't want to make it big. Honey Badger is always below 1,000 people. So we want to keep it.
That's nice as well.
Yeah. But for 10 years anniversary, we're going to have a limited amount of tickets. It's going to be 1,031. Mm-hmm. So 1031. 1031 is 31st of October. That was the famous date of when the white paper was published. Bitcoiners, they love numbers, obviously. So 1031 is 1,031. So it's going to be a limited amount. And if you don't get it, you don't get it. That's it.
Well, it's a great wishing list.
Yeah, and my another wish list is that we're probably going to make part of these tickets really, really affordable, or even all of them.
That's Andreas Antonopoulos all the way. He wouldn't go to a conference that was an expensive one because he wanted for everyone to be able to get in. Yeah,
but we also want to have a new event space. There's a nice event space in Riga, which is bigger than the event space where we're doing at the moment.
Okay.
So we're considering, you know, booking that one. Need to make a decision on the dates, because every time we have someone who we want to invite, there's always some kind of conflicting dates. I hope it's going to be big and it's going to be interesting and it's going to be relevant, and we're going to celebrate 10 years because it's a birthday, and we have basically 2 years to prepare, and it's way more better for us like this than doing every year.
I know it's going to be great. We are going to be there.
Thank you.